One is called The Discovery of Dynamics. And then the other one is a popular book, and it's called The End of Time. And today, he's going to speak on shape dynamics and general relativity.
Thank you very much. It's a very great pleasure to be back in Perimeter, and thanks to the organizers. And before I start and forget it, very many thanks to my collaborator, Flavio Mercati, who will be speaking at the workshop after me, for producing all my slides. I can assure you, at least that part of it might be looking good. So let's get straight down to business. And I want to start off by making clear distinguishing between two notions of relativity. There's Einsteinian relativity, with which you're very familiar. That relates to the relativity of the way you divide up space and time. But before that, Leibniz already, but Mach was advocating that position is defined, the position of any one object is defined relative to everything else in the universe. And practically, this is manifestly the case. My position in the first place is defined by the hall and you. So that's a quite different type of relativity. And what I'm going to argue is that if you develop the Machian notion of relativity plus a certain denial of the existence of time as something external in addition to what is actually in the world, this rather remarkably leads you to a theory of gravity which is dual in a sense which I hope to make clear, and also largely equivalent to general relativity. But it comes from a very different starting point. And I should say right away, we're going to finish up with a absolutely unambiguous notion of simultaneity, absolute simultaneity in the theory. And in a way, this is presupposed, I would say, in the very notion of a configuration. That is something that hangs together. It's knit together into a unity, which is a certain sort of simultaneity. And in a way, I'm trying to get away now from using the word relativity just because it carries so many notations. And I prefer to talk about spatial and temporal relationalism, as will Edward Anderson in a talk tomorrow in the workshop. So that's a starting point. So let's go on. Let's consider the Newtonian three-body problem. My collaborators joke at me for saying that probably quantum gravity will be solved with the toy model of the Newtonian three-body problem. I think nearly all of the really key ideas can be expressed by means of the three-body problem. In the Newtonian three-body problem, the particles at any instant are at the vertices of a triangle. And according to Newton, you must describe that by nine spatial quantities. Three determine the center of mass of the system, three more the orientation, one determines the size of the triangle, that's the scale, and two determine dimensionless ratios, angles, two angles that determine the shape of the triangle. In addition, Newton has time. So that's 10 quantities. And shape dynamics, the key starting point is that it's only shapes, dimensionless quantities that count. So I'm going to try and describe the whole of dynamics in terms of shapes and nothing else. And this leads me to say that the notion of space-time should be replaced by the notion of a principal fiber bundle. So in this diagram here, in the bottom, you have shape space. Each point in this shape space is a shape of a triangle. And the vertical fibers above that shape represent all ways in which you can imagine the shape of that triangle represented in Euclidean space in all different possible positions and with all different sizes. And underlying all this, and absolutely key to it, is the Euclidean similarity group, the similarity group of translations, rotations, and dilatations. And this will go through more or less with certain great enrichment into the dynamics of geometry. Now, the key thing when you have a principal fiber bundle structure, as we have here, is that the going up and down is to be regarded as pure gauge. So unlike Newton, who says this is real, when I do something like this according to Newton, something real is happening, although the triangle is not changing. Now we're going to assert that all of those other motions, except ones that change the shape of the triangle, are gauge. They're not physical at all. The only role that space plays in this is that holding together of the configuration by the distances or the dimensionalized distances where you divide out by the scale. So when you go up and down, this is going up and down the fiber, nothing is happening in physics if this is a model of the entire universe. Of course, something is happening here in the hall, but not if this were the entire universe. And then the key problem, though, is if you go to a different triangle, now I have a triangle with a different shape, the question is, how do I define the difference between those two triangles? And that's going to be the beginning and almost the end of the entire problem, however you generalize this. And the answer that we're going to give is completely universal because underlying it is the notion of a Lie group. And that's really what's at stake. So I'm going to formulate what I call a Mach-Poincaré principle based on an analysis which Poincaré made in 1902 of the problem of absolute or relative motion. He says there's been a lot of discussion of whether motion is absolute or relative, but I'm going to ask a precise question, he says. Is there any defect in Newtonian mechanics which arises from the use of absolute space? And he finds a very precise defect, and that's the following. He says, I'm a convinced relationist. I believe in the relativity of motion. If I believed in that, I would expect that if I have the relative separations of my particles and the rates of change of the relative separations, that's essentially two different triangles. These triangles are not congruent. That information alone should enable me to predict the evolution of the shape of the triangle. That's what he said as a convinced relationalist. And then he says, this is not possible in Newtonian mechanics. And it's not possible for two very important reasons. If I move, in Newtonian terms, if I move this triangle to this one by a translation, that does not affect the future evolution of the shapes of the triangle because of Galilean relativity. But if I rotate this one relative to that, I'm not changing the triangles one iota in themselves, but I'm changing the angular momentum in Newtonian terms. And that has drastic consequences on the subsequent evolution of the system. That angular momentum in Newtonian terms is invisible in the pure shape initial data. And there's one more thing you can do, which is change the size. You can put in an overall expansion of the system, and that too will change the evolution. So you have a four-parameter ambiguity in the future evolution from, so to speak, intrinsic initial data. And that's a serious problem, says Poincaré, and he didn't find a solution to it. But let me now formulate what I call the Mach-Poincaré principle, because there's endless discussion about what Mach's principle means. Let me state absolutely categorically, I will take poison on this. There is only one proper definition of Mach's principle. It is that, well, there's two options, and that's a very interesting issue. There's a strong form, which says that if I have a shape, that's a point in shape space, and I define a direction, I consider a direction in shape space, that's the way the shape is changing. That should define the evolution in shape space uniquely. That's what I call the strong form. The weak form just allows a one parameter freedom in this. It says a point and a tangent vector. That's just one, instead of having just a direction, you then give it a magnitude as well. And what I'm going to say is going to lead to an implementation of Mach's principle, which has a lot in common with what Jim Eisenberg and Wheeler were doing. I don't think Jim Eisenberg is here yet, is he? But he's going to be later in the workshop. Anyway, I am going to give the generic name shape dynamics to to any theory which satisfies either of these two principles. And I should give advance warning that my collaborators here in Tim Koslowski and Sean Gribb and Enrique Gomez use the word shape dynamics for slightly more precisely. It's one of these generic theories, and they will be talking about it in the workshop. So how are we going to implement the strong Mach-Poincaré principle? Well, it's very simple. You just find some way to define a metric on shape space. If I can say, If I can say that any two triangles, if I've got two triangles which are slightly different, if I can measure put a quantity that quantifies the difference between them, that's a metric on shape space. And then I can say the evolution that Poincaré wanted but couldn't find is a geodesic principle on the shape space. As soon as I've got a metric on the shape space, I'm away. And I'm going to be able to do that because, fortunately, the very geometry that defines my configurations in the first place and gives me that group that is behind this principal fiber bundle actually generates a metric up here on the fiber bundle up here. So nature gives me the group, and it gives me a metric which is more or less uniquely determined. And it's very easy to see that. I don't think I need my models yet. If I put the two triangles, the dotted triangle on top of the red triangle in any position, I get little distances. What's happened to the laser? Ah, there it is. That's delta x1, let's say delta x2, and that's delta x3. So I can take the scalar products, the norms of these quantities there, I can weight them by the masses, I can multiply by any function which depends only on shape space, so it's the separations between the particles, and I want this thing to have dimensions length to the minus 2, this is length plus 2, so if this is length minus 2, this only depends upon the shape, and therefore I've got a distance up in the fiber bundle between those two triangles. And then I can say, so this is clearly arbitrary because I've placed the two in an arbitrary position relative to each other. But then, with this quantity I've chosen here, which I'm going to use, this quantity here and this kinetic, this is like the Newtonian kinetic metric, I'm going to use this quantity to tell me the difference between those two triangles. They are incongruent, but I'm going to move them into what I call the best matched position, where they're as close to overlap as they possibly can be. And that, there will be a minimum. This is a positive definite quantity. There will be a minimum, and then that is my distance between the triangles. And this is what background independence means. Once I've got these two triangles into the best matched position, I can move them anywhere in space, orient them like that. I do not change that at all. That is what background independence is. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding in quantum gravity about what background independence is, but I believe that is the correct way to think about it. It's background independent with regards to space. It's also background independent in that I haven't used any notion of time to quantify that quantity, that difference. So I've got what I want there. So now I'm away. So I'm now going to introduce you to how it's done. I'm going to take an action which has this form here. It has a square root because I want a geodesic principle. Apologies for that. I think that's okay, is it? Everybody okay, hear me? Yeah. That square root is necessary to have a geodesic principle, but in one fell swoop, it gets rid of time. Time does not play any role in this. It's all done just with the differences of the coordinates. So that's the way to get rid of time. And then what is this next line here? So we have a kinetic energy term, which is very like Newton, except that this is a reparametrization invariant action. There's a d lambda squared underneath the t here, because this is quadratic, but there's a d lambda out there, that's reparametrization invariant, and you don't even need to put the d lambda there at all. So that's one feature of the thing. That's the temporal relationalism part of the story. And then these are correction terms which come from the best matching. Now, I've got the fibers here, and that distance that is defined on the fiber bundle gives an orthogonal separation, a horizontal separation between the fibers, which is constant at all heights. And what that best matching I did by moving my two triangles relative to the other was I started off with one position of the triangles like that, which corresponds to that connection there. But I best match, and it brings me down to pick up the horizontal separation. That's what best matching is. So it's as simple as it could be, really. So that's it there, and we've got the background independence. And I call that the minimum of that quantity the best matched difference between the triangles. And that's... haven't I shown that one already? I think I have. I want to show this because of the form of the canonical momentum. Now, the canonical momentum has a very characteristic property. There are two differences from the Newtonian momentum. First of all, there are these correction terms which come from my group corrections. This is best matching with respect to translations, rotations, and dilatations. So that's, first of all, those correction terms, which disappear when I've got it into the best matched position, and it looks just like the Newtonian one. And then there is this characteristic ratio here with the square root. So the canonical, that's the form of the canonical momentum. So now all we do to find our physical trajectory is we take a trial curve in the base space here, we run it along like that. The fibers that go above that trial curve, they form a sheet like that. And then we look at all curves which wander along here on that sheet. They mustn't leave the sheet. But they vary absolutely freely. Because we regard the vertical direction as pure gauge, that curve, I want to find the minimum of the distance along from here to here where that curve is completely free. And what will happen, because these things are at an equal separation as you go up, that you will pick up a curve which is essentially always horizontal all the way along, but you can lift it bodily as a complete curve all the way up. So there's a certain residual gauge freedom that is left there. But this is what I call Sean Gribb coined it, the Machian free endpoint variation. And it's not normally by free endpoint variation you have, so to speak, the ends are fixed on rails and they can move freely up and down on the rails. But what is happening in this case is you're requiring much stronger condition than that. You're saying that if I minimize here with these two ends fixed, and I then go somewhere in here where that curve goes, and then I find the extremalization between two neighboring ones there, I pick up exactly the same curve. That's a very important part of the definition of what we mean by that. Now, what is the canonical momentum here? The canonical momentum is just that horizontal velocity. You've got a horizontal velocity there when you put these correction terms in that come from best matching, and then it's just multiplied by that factor there. And in fact, the Lagrangian is just the sum of those squares there. So you're picking up the you're defining what you mean by the change, the velocity, and that leads me on to the next slide. And then you're weighting it by this quantity here. And then you go on to there, and you find that these momenta must satisfy constraints. They satisfy that the total momentum must be zero from the translational best matching, the total angular momentum must be zero, and this dilatational momentum, which is defined by that, must also be zero. This is in the fully scale invariant model. In addition, you have a quadratic constraint, which comes because we're talking about a geodesic. And now this is interesting because a very influential remark of Mach was that the universe is given only once, with its relative motions alone determinable. But what are relative motions? Well, the answer is it depends upon the group. It's up to you to decide what the group is that's appropriate. Because depending on which group you take, the translations or the rotations or all three, you will get different definitions of what is a true motion, what is a change, what is a true change in the universe there. And the larger you make the structure group, the less freedom you have in saying what is a true change in the universe, what is a true motion. So the choice of the structure group converts Mach's intuition into a precise theory. And all of this is very closely related to the development of the theory of Lie groups, which was actually going on exactly at the same time that Mach was writing, but Mach, not being a mathematician, probably wasn't very aware of that development. So let's go on. So now I'm going to not do what happens when you go fully scale invariant. I'm just going to do translationally and rotationally invariant. I'm going to put down a translationally and rotationally invariant action, which has this form. And perhaps some of you may have noticed that this is actually Jacobi's principle, the action for Jacobi's principle. This was the first mathematically correct formulation of the principle of least action given by Jacobi in 1837. He wasn't wanting to get rid of time, as I've been rather obsessed, but he was just wanting to formulate the principle of least action in a clean way. And what Jacobi's principle gives you, it has a fixed energy. E is a fixed energy. This E minus V was previously my W. It gives you, this is the Newtonian potential, say in the n-body problem. This is going to be identified as the total energy, but it's a constant. And it gives you the dynamical orbit of the system in its configuration space for one fixed energy. So in the Kepler two-body problem, it will give you the Keplerian ellipses, but not the speed at which they're traversed. So that's what you get. If you now, and I'm going straight away to put in the best matched displacements. So then you get this rather awkward looking equation of motion, which has got this awkward square root factor here. Now it cries out to be simplified. Now t can be given any value you like because lambda is completely arbitrary. So you can always choose lambda such that this relation holds. And then you've got Newton's second law. So what you've got out of this is that Newtonian dynamics emerges from the Machian dynamics. But there is one extra condition which you don't have in Newton. If you have an island universe of n particles in Euclidean space, which is how people thought about the universe at the end of the 19th century, the angular momentum of that universe must be exactly zero. And that's a prediction which Newton cannot make. But importantly, that restriction does not apply to subsystems. You can have lots of subsystems with angular momentum. The only requirement is that the total adds up to zero. And for what it's worth mentioning, when you look out at the universe, it's rather like that. You see lots of spiral galaxies and things with angular momentum in them, but no evidence that the universe as a whole has got what you might call angular momentum. And what you've got in addition is that you've got a local emergence of Newton's inertial frame of reference and absolute time. And I'm going to go on to the absolute time in a moment. So we start with less than Newton and we get more. And the emergence of time comes this way. You just invert that relation up there. Normally, if it was written E equals T plus V, you would say that's energy conservation. I would say for the universe, it isn't energy conservation, it's the definition of duration. Let us call that distinguished lambda, which makes that relation hold, let us call it dt, write out the explicit expression, and here you get this explicit expression. It's a sum, there's a square root, there's a sum, it's weighted with the masses, you have all the little displacements that the particles have made, and then you divide by 2e minus v. And this is the complete implementation of Mach's claim. It is utterly impossible to measure the changes of things by time. Quite the contrary, time is an abstraction at which we arrive from the changes of things. And seen in this way, time is the distillation of all the changes in the universe. And this is this arrival at the time of the duration of the whole universe. It's doubly holistic. First of all, you get it by using the best matched quantities, which is holistic comparison of everything in the universe. And secondly, you have to put in all the best matched displacements that you do get to get it. So this is an extremely holistic way. So you really are getting a totally different view of Newton. Newton introduced this idea of a perfectly uniform space, and then nothing seems more simple and obvious than that the fundamental law of nature is that a body left to itself goes in a straight line at a uniform speed. And I'll insist that that is a total and utter lie. And incidentally, it's the basis of reductionism. What we see here is that the whole universe is involved in creating the local framework here. And the reason we're not aware of the whole universe doing it is because the principle, the whole universe, through the principle of least action, is grabbing hold of us all in exactly the same way. So we don't notice the effect of the universe locally. But we are picking it up by identifying the local inertial frame of reference. There is one very intriguing question in here, is what is the status of E? You could either regard this as being given once and for all as part of the universal law of the universe, or you could regard it as a contingent initial condition. Poincaré pointed that out in the discussion I mentioned. So now let's just look at how Newtonian space-time arises. I've got this picture where I've best matched my triangles. I'd need four to do it. So I first of all get my two triangles into the best match position, and then say three and four, just so that I match three, isn't it, Flavio? There. So I've got them into that's horizontal stacking, and then I just put that distinguished separation between them, which leads me to Newton's second law. And I build it up like that, and I've got Newton's inertial frame of reference in the center of mass frame, because the translational best matching brings the center of mass to coincidence. And that's a distinguished representation. It reflects the true physics, because that's really what we feel around us. That's why we feel centrifugal force on a roundabout or something like that. And it simplifies the equations. And that's how you get Newtonian space-time. I'm not going to go into great details, but exactly the same thing can be done with a space-time, the Einsteinian space-time. Now, from Minkowski on, everybody has, so to speak, started by assuming that space-time is there in its totality, that time is essentially identical to space. This is what Minkowski said. And it's a Lorentzian space-time, and you consider all of Lorentzian space-times that are kinematically there, possible, and then you use the Einstein-Hilbert action to find those that satisfy the Einstein equations. And you start with the ontology of space-time, where time is on exactly the same footing as space, or virtually the same footing. And I would say this is very, potentially very, very misleading. If shape dynamics is going in the right direction, that notion of time must be shed. It isn't like that at all. It is, as I showed you, something much more like that expression from the previous slide. Now, what will happen in shape dynamics when we come to geometry, which we will in a moment, is that we start off, we start off just with two, three geometries, or conformal geometries. This is where, I'll come into that in a bit more detail when I get to it. But let me just anticipate it. Basically, I'm not starting with a space-time ontology at all. I'm just starting with where only angles in a three-dimensional space have meaning, and I have matter fields in that. It's all expressed purely in terms of angles. There's no time in the picture at all, but I just have two possible spatial configurations defined purely in terms of shapes, and I'm going to do a vastly more sophisticated best matching process where every point here is, so to speak, compared with every point there, and also the scales in the geometry, and that will lead to space-time in a very particular foliation. So it will be space-time will be the end product, not the starting point in this, and I think it has potential implications for all sorts of things. So let's go on to the next one. I just will now conclude the particle model, which was really, so to speak, the toy model part of this, by pointing out that the strong form requires that quantity D down here should vanish. That comes from the best matching with respect to dilatations. So in the strong form, that must be zero. And if that is zero, it also, by the way, enforces that E must be equal to zero. And in this case, we have a point and a direction in shape space determine the evolution. In the weaker form, you can allow, we don't best match with respect to dilatations. We just have the total momentum and total angular momentum is zero, and we impose ad hoc that E is equal to zero. And this situation is what the n-body specialists call the scale-invariant n-body problem, which has many very interesting properties. And one of them is that this quantity here is, if the energy is zero or positive by a famous qualitative result that Lagrange found, the center of mass moment of inertia of the system is concave upwards, and this quantity is monotonic. And it's then very interesting to introduce an internal time, which is the ratio of this quantity y at two different points. So I've got my curve in shape space, and at two points on it, I can determine the value of this dimensionless ratio, where this is the dimension. This is the definition of y. This is, by the way, the two equivalent definitions of the center of mass moment of inertia, which is a key quantity and is analogous to the volume of the universe in a spatially closed universe. And this is going to be very interesting because, first of all, it's a very good toy model of general relativity without a cosmological constant. And secondly, it means that we can represent absolutely everything we need in dimensionless terms. I do insist that all of the reality resides in the curve in shape space. We know that only dimensionless quantities have meaning in physics, so everything that counts is in that curve in shape space. And also, it's no good having a time which has got dimensions, because that's not acceptable in this framework. So instead of time in Newtonian mechanics, it's a difference of time that is important in the variational principle, and it's a difference of something which has dimensions. In shape space, in this representation, you have a dimensionless time, and it's derived from a ratio. And I think this could be very significant for quantum gravity. So now let me go on to the dynamics of geometry. And in 1854, Riemann introduced the idea of Riemannian geometry. He introduced the notion of a metric tensor, a 3x3 symmetric tensor. And it's very interesting. In that paper, he says quite explicitly, when I measure the length of something, I have to have a measuring rod and put it against the interval I want to measure. But I'm going to assume that it is meaningful to say that an interval over here has the same length as an interval over here. And that is very suspicious, because it's rather analogous to the issue of simultaneity at spatially separated points. And it was a long time before Weyl picked up on that in a somewhat different form through parallel transport in 1918. Then in 1870, Clifford had translated Weyl's paper into English, and he conjectured famously that perhaps the whole world is nothing but curved pieces of curved space moving around relative to each other. A little bit later, Mach insisted that all motion is relative. In 1902, Poincaré gave what I regard as the precise formulation of what a theory of relative motion should achieve. Now, suppose that then Weyl's insight had come before Einstein had created general relativity. This is a bit of counterfactual history. I'm going to say what might have come out of that, taking those bits there. So essentially, Weyl introduced what he called parallel transport of length to remove what he regarded as an unacceptable rigidity of Riemannian geometry. We're going to go about it differently. We're just saying that that scale factor that is sitting inside of the three geometry is gauge. So let me go on. So just remind you what the Riemannian three metrics do. There's the, it defines a dimensionful distance through this expression, but it defines two dimensionless angles through the cosine like that. So what we have here in the six independent components in the metric, three are coordinate information and one is scale. And we declare that all those four are gauge and that all remains are two angles, which are the physical data. So that's going to be the position we take. And then there are various infinite dimensional spaces that need to be considered. Riem is the space of all three metrics defined on a closed three-manifold M. And any two metrics, Gij, that can be carried into each other by diffeomorphisms, three-dimensional diffeomorphisms, represent the same three geometry. And that is superspace, the quotient of Riem with respect to three-dimensional diffeomorphisms. And you generate an infinitesimal three-dimensional diffeomorphism by means of a three-vector field, which acts like this, where this is the symmetrized covariant derivative of the vector field, or alternatively, you can look at it also as the Killing form here and the Lie derivative of the metric, that quantity. So that's how you implement diffeomorphisms infinitesimally. And then conformal transformations are a lot more easy. You can have full conformal transformations where you multiply by a factor here, phi must be real. This is just multiplying the scaling the metric either up and down at each space point. So this is going to be at each space point. So this is where the first real generalization from my toy particle model occurs. I can do that scaling and those diffeomorphisms at each space point, have an action with that. So really what I've got here is the similarity group at each space point. So I've got infinitely many copies of the similarity group that I can play with. Then it's going to be key for what we do to get the match up with general relativity that we make a tiny restriction on that and insist on volume preserving conformal transformations with this VPCT abbreviation. This is where you say that your changing of the scale factor must, when you can make it completely freely at any space point, but at the end of it, you must not change the total volume of the three geometry, of the space at that point. And this is going to be absolutely key because it's actually going to be what allows the universe to expand. And you do that, there's a simple way to do it, where you take a completely free phi and then you knock it back by, this is the formula for doing it, essentially this is the original volume before you started, this is the transformed volume which will be bigger or smaller, and then you multiply the thing in this way to get the quantity that you to make sure that it doesn't change the total volume. So that's what happens there. And so now we have two conformal superspaces, and I want to introduce just the notion of the geometrical group, because it seems to me so utterly natural to consider this post-Riemann, that first of all, there's the three-dimensional diffeomorphisms, and then there's the three-dimensional conformal transformations, possibly restricted to be volume-preserving. And nothing could be more natural, starting with that train of thought that goes back to Clifford, to say that my theory of dynamical geometry, also when coupled to matter, must be invariant under the combination of those. I guess technically it's called the semi-direct product, is it? But I shall call it the geometrical group. That would be the full one. And then, so conformal superspace is the quotient of Riemann with respect to this thing. So that's any two, three metrics that can be carried into each other by a combination of three diffeomorphisms and three-dimensional conformal transformations. And then if you act with that restriction where you insist on volume preservation, then you get conformal superspace plus volume, as we call it, CS plus V. And that is actually going to be the gauge group that will lead us to a dual form of gravity related to general relativity, that's dual to general relativity. So let me just show you those pictures again and show you how close they are to the one with the three-body problem. On the left, we've got superspace, where the gauge group is the three-dimensional diffeomorphisms. Here's some curve in Riemann, and here is the curve in superspace. This is a succession of three geometries. And in this case, we've added the conformal transformations as well. That gives us conformal superspace. And this is where we'll have conformal geometrodynamics playing out, and this will be where geometrodynamics, that's John Wheeler's coining there. And if you can add matter fields, this is actually going to be covered in the workshop talks by Enrique Gomez, if I'm right. Enrique, correct? So that can be done remarkably easily. So now there are two possible actions for geometrodynamics. There is the key thing is how you get rid of time. And that's always done with a square root. And there are two possibilities. One is to take a direct analog of Jacobi's principle, where this corresponds to the t that occurs in Jacobi's principle. This is quadratic. You integrate over space, and then you have a potential term where this is any three scalar, and also you integrate over space. You take the product of them, and then you take a square root of the whole lot. And that's a global degree of freedom. Now, a global square root. And that is going to give you three local degrees of freedom, because you've just taken out the, at this stage, we're only talking about diffeomorphisms, so you're taking out just the three coordinate bits of information. And in this, the form of the T, now this was in the workshop talk this morning, what is rather wonderful about geometry is that there's the kinetic term, if you want anything that's at all simple, the kinetic term is almost uniquely determined except for one very mysterious parameter, lambda, which has this form here, where you take the velocities, and lambda is equal to 1 in the Dewitt supermetric. So that's one possibility. The other possibility, which is infinitely more interesting and leads, I would say, to virtually all the potentially useful things that are sitting inside shape dynamics, is to take what we call the local square root, where you multiply some local scalar by that same kinetic term, and at each space point you then take the square root, and then you integrate all of those square roots. So you've got an integration over space, and then you do the integrate over dt. And here I must mention that the possibility of doing this with a local square root was pointed out to me by Karol Kuchosz in 1980, So far as I know, nobody else in relativity had noted the significance of a local square root like that. And then what comes out of it is very largely thanks to Nilo Muruk, who a very major input. And I'm very sorry Neil is not here. It was just because he's in Shanghai at the moment, and getting out of China and then getting back in again was just administratively too difficult for him to be here. But Neil's input into this has been a colossal.
So, Julia,
yep.
I have a question. So, aren't you deviating from your best matching principles when you do local square root?
We haven't come to it yet.
I mean, you haven't come to it?
I haven't done best matching yet. I'm only getting rid of time at this stage. No, absolutely not. No, it's not necessary. No, the thing about this is that you deal with those two aspects to get a relational theory in completely different ways. The time aspect, the temporal aspect, is just done with a square root, one of the two options. The other one is best matching, which we're coming to in a moment. And it's completely separate, unlike where it's all mixed together in the four-dimensional diffeomorphisms in general relativity. What I should say also is that this form of the action is going to lead to, at each space point, a factor W divided by T, which means that you're going to have a local definition of time like that. So if you had gone in with the spirit of locality, it might well have been that you would have hit upon this local square root to achieve a local definition of time. Because after all, you look at your wristwatch and I look at mine, and it's just looking at something local. And we want to have a theory which explains why that can be done, and we can make sensible clocks. So that could have been a justification for this. Now, I should say in all honesty that Bertotti and I, back in 1980, hit upon this thing, knowing nothing about what is actually going to turn out to be the Beilein-Sharp-Wheeler action to anticipate a moment. And it was Kukash who drew our attention to the local square root.
If I may interject for another second. So
yep.
Just to compare to Petrus talk, so the global square root is the projectable version of Petrus theory, and the local square root is the non-projectable version of
Petrus.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that would be, yes. Yes, thank you. That's put in our terms. That's translating Petrus' sort of theory into our terms. Yep. So now you're going to get constraints here. You immediately get a quadratic constraint because of those local square roots, and it's one at each space point. So you get a quadratic constraint which has this form here, and it's identical to the quadratic constraint in ADM if you choose W to be this. This is the cosmological constant now, and little lambda to be 1. At each space, so you have this quadratic constraint at each space point. So you see this is very closely related to general relativity. And then you get a linear constraint from best matching, which is just the divergence of the canonical momentum must vanish. So that's the ADM momentum constraint. And that arises from best matching. At this stage, we're only doing with respect to the diffeomorphisms. And that's equivalent to the introduction of a Lagrange multiplier, which is a three-vector field, and then changing the velocity and varying with respect to this as a Lagrange multiplier. And that leads directly to that, exactly as you get in ADM. So we are getting very close to ADM. Now, this was one of the things that Nilo Muruk noticed, was that if you have the local square root, it's an extraordinarily strong selector of consistent theories. This was the point Ed was making at this morning about you can easily write down lots of actions, but there's no guarantee that they're going to be consistent when you've gone through the full Dirac analysis. And this was what Neil realized. And essentially, it's very hard to get anything that looks simple, sensible, and non-trivial unless you choose that scalar term to be this. It could be plus or minus to allow for Euclidean general relativity. and the lambda, the little lambda, to be 1. Also possible, this will be covered in Flavio Mercati's talk after I've finished today and we've had tea, that you can allow lambda not equal to 1, and that's quite interesting. It leads to further constraints, and you have to do a Dirac analysis. And very interesting is what happens when you couple to matter with either of those possibilities, and that also will be covered by Flavio Mercati. That goes back to a paper with the title which Nila Murahu suggested, Relativity Without Relativity. Very remarkably, a universal light cone comes out of just requiring consistency of this. So what we actually get in this way of doing it is we first of all get general relativity, then we try and couple matter to it, and we find that we get a universal light cone for the matter. And if we then try and go a bit further and we couple a vector field, for example, lo and behold, a single vector field, lo and behold, it has to be Maxwell. So this is a very interesting way of arriving at modern physics, admittedly not quantum mechanics. So the Machian free endpoint variation here, we're still only talking about the diffeomorphisms. So here what we have done, here is superspace. Here are these fibers corresponding to a fixed three geometry. So now I fix a three geometry here and try and extremalize the that action that I showed you before, where I fix the endpoints here. So I mustn't move away from the three geometries there. And what I find to my dismay is that I get a whole host of extremal curves here. These are all extremal curves down there. And this is actually just recovering the foliation invariance of general relativity. If you only best match with respect to diffeomorphisms, the three-dimensional diffeomorphisms, you get general relativity with its full foliation invariance there. This is a Cauchy surface down here. Here is space-time here. And the two different foliations correspond to the two different curves there. So we've got a local time. We wanted a local time, so we put the local square root in. But the result is that we get a crass failure of the Mach-Poincaré principle because there's vast numbers of curves with the same initial point and direction or the same initial point and tangent vector down there. So what do we do about that? Well, now we start thinking about a conformally... We start thinking about trying conformal best matching. And here we run into a problem which Nila Murahu again immediately saw. And he did something which is on the face of it outrageous from people who are used to gauge theory, where we saw those fibers running vertically. That's a key part of gauge theory, to having those fibers running vertically. Neil said, of course, thanks to tensor analysis, it's very easy to write down scalars under the three-dimensional diffeomorphisms. That's very easy. But if you start trying to do that with the conformal group, it's diabolically difficult. So in fact, he suggested that we take an action of this form here, where we're looking just like the one we had before. The T is conformally covariant. I think it is actually invariant. It's a scalar, isn't it? That's okay. That bit of it is there. But this does not transform in any sensible way under a conformal transformation. When you go up and down the conformal fibers, this transforms, but much more seriously and very significantly, the scalar curvature goes to this pretty gruesome expression here where you get a Laplacian coming in. And this is now going to establish the connection between Jimmy York's method of finding solutions for the initial value problem, which is totally reliant upon this non-covariant transformation law for the three-dimensional scalar curvature. And on the face of it, you would have said that's not a way to do a sensible theory, to take an action that has that non-covariant property. But Neil, who was Jimmy York's first student and proved important results with Jimmy, and he just had that inner gut feeling that things would work out well. So he said, right, let's go ahead and we'll take an action like that and see what happens. And For me, this is what has led to all the interesting aspects of conformal shape dynamics. Now, my collaborators, as the people in the workshop will hear, have got a slightly different take on this, but basically, that we have got where we are is entirely due to Neil taking that decision to go ahead with an action like that. So let me just highlight what it is. In ordinary gauge theory, you have the fibers are parallel, and as you go up and down a fiber with a gauge transformation, you have a gauge parameter, which is a function of lambda, the arbitrary parameter along your base, the curve in the base space. This depends upon lambda, so it has a value and it has a derivative with respect to lambda. And if the fibers are equidistant, nothing happens if you go up and down the thing by changing the phi, but if you, sorry, changing the phi, that's over here. But if you change the phi dot, I'm a bit short-sighted and can't see, that is the phi prime there. That's the best matching when you pick up the horizontal separation. That's what happens in standard gauge theory. And if you try to do this in particle theory, I'll leave that out and come back to it. If you go over to here, what essentially Neil was doing was introducing, having a metric, taking a metric which is given essentially by the DeWitt supermetric on the fiber bundle. This is ream up here, or rather the conformal part of it. And these are the conformal fibers going up here. If you happen to have a situation where there's not equidistant separation all the way up, but there is a unique point where you can find a horizontal component at a specific height and it's unique, then you can project that down as the separation between the two fibers, and you've got your geodesic principle on shape space and you're away. And that's actually what really happened there. So you've got these two independent things there, and you have to vary both. This here is an identity here, because in standard gauge theory, what you've got is a gauge, something which is parametrizing your gauge transformations. Only the velocity occurs, not the transformation itself, the parameter itself. But here, both appear. And that's the key difference in this case here. And first of all, we were trying to... I was obsessed for a long time with thinking there's something that stinks about the expanding universe. It seems very strange that the universe is expanding. What is the scale that is letting that happen? And so our first attempt was to create a theory in which the universe is not expanding and changing its shape, becoming more inhomogeneous, which is manifest, but is only changing its shape. And that can be done with this action here, where you can do that, where you divide the action that we had before by the two-thirds power of the volume. And that makes it homogeneous in G and in this phi when you introduce the phi to do the conformal transformations. And then you can go through this Machian free endpoint variation. And now the remarkable thing is you start off here with a trial curve here. So you fixed a trial curve in the base space. You fix an initial point on the fiber or anywhere there, and you find that you're taken to a unique point there. You're taken to a unique point in conformal superspace, in superspace. This is the superspace now. And you get a unique curve in superspace. So it fixes the scale. You start off with a theory which has no scale in it, and suddenly the solution of this problem puts a scale into it. And this is what is actually happening in the York method. So that's a really very dramatic thing. But that, after we got rather excited about that, we realized that it didn't seem to be in any way possible to explain the wealth of data in cosmology which suggests that the universe is expanding. So then we thought, can we actually characterize what GR is? And then we hit on this idea of volume-preserving conformal transformations, that is the gauge group for general relativity if you want to have a universe that can expand. And so that is what we did. So we just took that same action. And by the way, this is the... Let me just... I didn't fully say that about the Beilein-Sharpe-Wheeler action. The Byline-Sharpe-Wheeler action was found in 1962, and it was found in a very simple way. In the ADM formalism, the lapse appears quadratically, and you can solve for it algebraically. And that leads you straight to the Byline-Sharpe-Wheeler action. And I think this is very interesting, because the lapse in ADM in Einstein is reflecting relativity of simultaneity. But when we start off with that local square root, it's to have a local notion of clocks at each space point, which is not the same as worrying about simultaneity. So there's the simplest imaginable duality between a lack of simultaneity in general relativity and having a local clock, and a local emergent notion of duration. And finally, after struggling how to represent volume-preserving conformal transformations, we finally worked out the theory. Edward Anderson is here. As I say, regrettably, Neil is not, and I think this thing is fine. Oh, no, it's still working. In a paper which was published in Classical and Quantum Gravity. And let me just tell you a little bit about what that paper does. You get the following constraints here. The canonical momentum, again, is found in that way. It's going to have these characteristic square roots at each space point. Here is the trace of the canonical momentum. This is the trace-free part. You get a diffeomorphism constraint, exactly as in standard general relativity. You get a conformal constraint. It's very important that it's a constant and not the general form is that it's a spatial constant, but it can be time dependent. It's not zero in general. Then these two constraints, you can plug them into the quadratic constraint, and that leads to a modified Lichnerowicz-York equation. I'm not going to go through York's method of solving the initial value problem for general relativity, but you get York's key equation, the Lichnerowicz-York equation, and furthermore, you get a consistency condition, which leads to a lapse fixing condition. Now, I'm going to talk about constant mean curvature foliations in a moment, but what you get is all of York derived from a well-formulated gauge principle. And one of the key things about York's work was the particular form of the scaling for the trace term here, which he had to introduce ad hoc. He just was trying to find a sensible, he was trying to get an equation which had an existence and uniqueness property. A unique solution always exists. And he just happened to find that if he chose the scaling of this quantity appropriately compared with the other ones, which looked outrageous from just looking at the quantities, you would say that's not the way it should scale. But he found that he got what he wanted, and he got initial data that satisfied the constraints of general relativity. The first real thing about that paper of the previous slide, which I reread both that and a precursor of it, we didn't make nearly enough emphasis on that point. But it certainly was something that highly delighted Neil when we got it, and Brian Keller, who actually did the calculations in the end, was that it follows necessarily the scaling law that York had to impose ad hoc. We get it as a necessary consequence of the gauge principle. So that's the first thing. And then in addition to what York got, York just got initial data on what is called a constant mean curvature foliation. We, in addition, get an insistence that gauge, the variational principle, is telling you that you must continue the evolution in that constant mean curvature foliation. So having talked about that, let me go on. I'm nearly at the end now. Constant mean curvature foliations are analogous to soap bubbles in three dimensions. They have this beautiful constant curvature, extrinsic curvature. In four dimensions, they are closely analogous. This is this nice diagram which Flavio did for me there. So York just essentially introduced that foliation of space-time as a gauge fixing and found that it enabled him to get solutions to the initial value problem. We are forced to it from the gauge principles that we've invoked, and we are told that we must continue the propagation in it in the way that we did it. Now, my collaborators have got a slightly different thing, but the end result is the same, that what you get, what this gives you, is a curve in conformal superspace. The entire dynamical content of general relativity, both with and without matter, for in the spatially closed case, can be represented as a curve in conformal superspace where the initial condition is a point and a tangent vector, and the tangent vector gets its magnitude because of that dimensionless independent variable, which is a ratio of York times. So we've got this situation there that there is a time variable. The Hamiltonian is time dependent, but you've got a phase space which is even dimensional. So let me end now. This is not quite my last slide. This is my penultimate slide. I just want to give a little bit of a trailer for the talks that are going to come. Just about nearly 2 years ago, Enrique Gomez, Sean Gribb, and Tim Kozlovsky, they're all here today, put this into a very nice, rigorous form in phase space, where you can really do proper Dirac analysis. You can exploit all the positive features of phase space. And what they show, I think it's very remarkable, is that there are two coexisting first-class theories on the ADM phase space. There is the ADM constraint surface. There's the shape dynamic constraint surface. They intersect on the CMC foliation, so to speak. And that is really where the physics unfolds in these two theories there. And I think this shows that there's a hidden symmetry in general relativity. Particularly at the moment, Tim and Enrique are trying to exploit both of these symmetries at once. I won't attempt to say how they're doing it. Tim has coined the expression doubly general relativity. I might slightly prefer to say doubly general relational dynamics or something, just because I think if this does fly, we're going to have to rethink a lot of the conceptual things that have been drummed into you from Einstein. For example, let me just end by saying that Einstein, in his autobiographical notes, had said he'd committed a sin by not giving a proper dynamical account of what are rods and clocks. He takes them in as external things and just says they measure what the metric is. That's the interpretation of the metric. And I think actually Einstein, it's clear from those autobiographical notes of his in 1948 that he thought that when that was done, it would be not very much that would happen. My belief that's not true, that actually a very profound change is necessary. And it will be necessary to think completely anew about what is time, what is a measuring rod, and what is a clock. So let me come to the very final slide, which is the summary. And if I can, I'll go and read it from the thing here. That'll solve my eyesight problem. So the summary is, specification of a point and tangent vector in conformal superspace determines a slab of space-time in CMC foliation and a unique curve in conformal superspace. You have almost perfect implementation of Mach's principle. That almost perfect is just that volume conserving restriction, which may be actually a great virtue. And it's amazing. You start off with a theory which has got no local proper distance, or local proper time, or local inertial frames of reference. You just have a point and a tangent vector in conformal superspace, and out of that, everything emerges. So the fact that I've got a thing here and it's the same length as my hand here, and over here it's essentially the same, that has come out of the most colossal, holistic solution of elliptic equations in an instant, in absolute simultaneity, in the whole universe. And I think this is a very wonderful result. And as far as I'm concerned, it's very largely the work of Jimmy York and Nilo Murukhu. And I think it remains a mystery. Why is it that you have a shape velocity as opposed to a shape direction? It seems to me it's almost the last vestige of Newton's absolute space and time. We have a unique absolute time, but it is not independent of what is happening in the world. It's totally and utterly determined by everything that is happening in the world. And it's that shape velocity that makes it possible to talk about expansion of the universe. And my one reason that might be is that then you do have an even dimensional phase space. And Dirac always used to talk about the Darling transformation theory in quantum mechanics. And that relies upon the momentum space having the same number of dimensions as the configuration space. And that's what we get here. So maybe it's the quantum theory of the universe insists upon an even dimensional phase space, and that is the ultimate reason why we live in an expanding universe. Thank you.
That's great. Do we have questions? Okay. I'll start.
Yes, I'm sorry to say that this last response to you to the problem of the expanding universe seems to be so much at odds with your entire philosophy that I was thinking, is there no different answer to say? Why don't you say the size of the universe is totally meaningless as well, except you have to look at the size of the universe compared to the size of the atoms in there? You said adding matter is not difficult. Well, if you add matter, you add atoms and molecules and whatnot. So the size of those atoms is also meaningless, except that the ratio of the atoms and the size of the universe is a shape, and that thing can evolve.
I don't know whether I can give full justice to an answer to that one. Let me make one observation, that the evidence for the expanding universe is expressed in shapes which are nothing to do with relative sizes of atoms and the separations between the galaxies. I've actually done this when I was starting a PhD in astrophysics, comparing a wavelength from a galaxy with a wavelength generated in the laboratory. And you put the two things next to each other, and you see that one wavelength is different from another. So all of the facts on which the conclusion that the universe expands is based on shapes. The evidence is in shapes, as it must be, because otherwise it's meaningless. Now, to your answer, this is going to come out I don't know whether I'm anticipating too much of Enrique's talk there, but the picture I have of a conformal metric gives you angles between curves, between vector fields. And I take the viewpoint that that's all that is, so to speak, real, and there isn't a question of a size of an atom or something. If you go down really to the most fundamental level, my belief is that actually at each space point there's something like a celestial sphere where you see where these vector fields are going out, these fields that Faraday introduced, that are going out and are sort of like stars on the sky, and there's an angle between them. And I'm hoping to say that you must have a scalar product, it seems to me, in physics to be able to introduce numbers into physics. And I think it comes just at the level of SO3 acting on the celestial sphere, that you have an inner
product. The size of the universe is normally expressed in terms of the size of the meter or whatever, which is defined in terms of local wavelengths. So local, and that's just the size of atoms. So eventually, the size of the universe is compared to the size of the atoms in the universe. There's no absolute meaning to it, just like there's no absolute meaning to the size of atoms.
I would say the following. In this way that we start off, with a conformal three geometry with matter fields in it like this, and then we just pick two points in the conformal, within one conformal point, and we say this is the length of the king's foot, or the length of Queen Juliana's foot. That is my unit of distance, exactly as they defined the unit of distance in the Middle Ages. and then through this solution of the Lichnerowicz-York equation and all those things, then this unit of distance gets transmitted to the entire space-time. It all comes out of that one moment there. And then I think that it's patterns of how these things, the shapes of these things, when you get a collection of them together, where they have sort of some characteristic possibility which enables you to say, that's an object and has a certain stability, then you can pick on that and that say that's a length. But this is at the most fundamental level, I think it comes from just that one statement and this amazing solution of the Lichnerowicz-York equation, what it does.
Okay, Julian, with regard to this last issue of time, I'm confused, and so let me ask a two-part question. If you go back to the particle models, the Barrow-Bertoni models, you can say, am I right to say that there, when you find the time gauge which removes all the non-locality and reduces the dynamics to Newtonian dynamics, you've discovered not Newton's absolute time, because there was no absolute time, you've discovered a relational dynamical time which is present everywhere, and we can think metaphorically or really about the universe controlling the flow, the rate of time everywhere. And that's, would you agree that that's really what time is in the context of that model?
Yes.
Okay. Now, it seems to me that this same story can be told in your versions of general relativity, and the same story goes through irrespective of whether or not the volume of the universe is an observable or is not an observable. You discover that there is a fixed foliation, you discover that there is locally a rate of flow of time with respect to that fixed foliation. That would work in your 2005 paper as well as your present one. So both of them, time is dynamical, relational, and global.
Global.
Yes.
Simultaneity is global. I think what you're getting down to probably is what you would think of as something like a gravitational difference of rates of clocks, that you would have clock. Absolute simultaneity is in this approach inescapable in the mathematics.
Good.
But the clocks here, identical clocks here, would not necessarily go at the same rate. Well, they won't because of the gravitational redshift.
Sure.
That will be recovered.
So this global notion of time is not something which is locally measurable. To know what are the observers whose clocks measure this global notion of time, you have to solve an elliptic equation involving the whole universe.
And there are issues about this, about whether CMC foliations are really unique. And I mean, there's quite a lot of theories, theorems and results about that.
So there's no contradiction with local Lorentz invariance being a local
symmetry.
No,
this is a remarkable thing. Local Lorentz invariance for local experiments is completely reserved because you get a universal light cone. It's totally, you have your cake and eat it. It's an amazing result.
So in either case, why aren't you happy to say that you have, not that you have eliminated time, but that you've discovered time, and time is global and relational and dynamical and is really the whole universe acting on us?
I'd be happy, and of course, I'm called Julian, and the successor of Constantine, who put the Roman Empire back to paganism, was Julian the Apostate. So, to some extent, I'm reintroducing a sort of time. And in fact, conceivably, yes, because at the moment I'm beginning to think it's possibly a time-dependent Schrödinger equation that one really should be thinking about to describe the universe, yes.
One last short question.
I don't know whether this is short, but in four-dimensional space-time, Maxwell's equations are conformally invariant. The group is SO4,2. It's a 15-parameter group. The reason this happens is because the trace of the energy-momentum tensor is zero. Now, for the matter-energy-momentum tensor, it is not traceless. So the question is, how do you break conformal invariance to get mass? And the other part of the question is, the first 10 parameters or 15 parameters corresponds to the metric, scaling of the metric. What are the other 5 parameters corresponding to physically?
Ask my collaborators who was it against Obama? That's above my pay grade when he was asked about abortion. No, but the other one, that's a bit of a flippant thing. I'm not an expert on the 15-dimensional thing, but there was something that came before that, John. Oh, yes. I think what is really significant about Poincaré's formulation of the problem is that he asks, what initial data must I specify to get a solution? And I think it's largely a historical accident that the way we think about physics today is determined largely by Noether's theorem from 1918 or 1919 and Dirac's lectures on quantum mechanics, which is really the rigorous Hamiltonian exploration of the consequences of Noether's theorem part two. And because of those two things, everybody, and the great success of the standard model with Gates theory, everybody concentrates on the symmetry of the action. Now, this approach, based going back to Poincaré, says I want an action where I specify the initial data in shape dynamic terms as just a point and a tangent vector in shape space, and then I look for any action that will meet that requirement. All is fair in love and war, and all is fair in implementing the Mach-Poincaré principle. And therefore, I think the emphasis on the symmetry of the action is perhaps going to be downgraded. If, again, this flies, we will look about it differently. We will go back to Poincaré. Interestingly, that 1902 Science and Hypothesis book of Poincaré was read closely by Einstein. And as far as I know, neither he nor anybody else noted that analysis of his of what is wrong with Newtonian mechanics. Very interesting thing. Jim Peebles was talking in Oxford last week, or the week before, saying, "You all over science, you find things where somebody makes an observation and it goes unnoticed for decades." And this, I think, is what happened with Poincaré. Okay,
so we should finish there. Before we thank the speaker, let me remind you there will be post-colloquium snacks outside. So let's thank Julian once again for a wonderful talk.
Thank you.